طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Before we get to our feature presentation from a forum at the Columbia University Law School, we want to take a minute to point out how once again, in the midst of devastating heat in Palestine, Israel is using the withholding of water as a weapon to inflict illegal collective punishment on the Palestinian population. Israel controls all the water in Israel-Palestine, even the water it extracts from the West Bank aquifer and the water under Gaza. It is liberal with water allocations to Israelis to fill their pools and bellies and water their shrubbery, but allocates little to Palestinians to meet the basic necessities for survival. And it charges four times as much money to Palestinians than it does to Israelis to purchase water, even for water it extracts from Palestinian territory. Adila, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, sent a letter to senior Israeli government, military, and water officials this week demanding that they cease cutting water supplies to Palestinian residents of the occupied West Bank. But right now, it is worse than ever. There are areas of the West Bank that have received no water at all for weeks. Livestock are dying, fields and gardens are drying up, and factories and businesses are shutting down. We encourage you to Google the Boston Alliance for Water Justice to follow reports on this latest brutal assault on the Palestinian people and to join them in their organizing attempts to challenge Israel's assault on Palestine's basic right to survival. They are calling a demonstration in front of the Massachusetts State House on Beacon Hill on Thursday, July 14th at noon. Google Boston Alliance for Water Justice for details. And now on to our feature presentation. This past spring of 2016, Columbia University Law School held an interesting forum it called The Palestinian Exception to the First Amendment and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. This morning we will bring you presentations from that forum by Columbia University Law Professor Catherine Franke, Jewish Voice for Peace's Rebecca Vilcomersom, and Columbia Student Organizer for Students for Justice in Palestine, Shaza Abushi Dela, speaking at the forum. In her presentation, Professor Franke makes reference to legislation pending in the New York State Legislature concerning legislation that would punish those who chose to do business with any entity that supported the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Please note that that legislation has now been signed into law by New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo. And now, from the Forum on the Palestinian Exception to the First Amendment and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement at Columbia University Law School, we begin with Professor Catherine Franke.
Well, welcome, everybody. This is so exciting to see so many of you in this room. So I want to do just a little introduction about boycotts generally. The issues that we're specifically talking about today have to do with the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment and BDS more generally. But my comments, just to set up my co-panelists, will have to do with boycotts more generally. Many of you, I'm sure, are aware and have liked and shared the fact that Bruce Springsteen canceled an event in North Carolina. Right? The governor of the state of New York, the governor in a number of other states, the mayor of the city of New York, and mayors in a number of other states have also pledged to boycott the state of North Carolina, and increasingly the state of Mississippi, because of laws that have been passed in North Carolina, Mississippi, Georgia. I just ran down from my office working on a letter analyzing the problems with a similar bill that's before the Missouri legislature. Boycotts are a familiar tool of pretty much every social movement. The Boston Tea Party was a boycott. We're all very familiar with the Montgomery bus boycott, where people of color boycotted the use of public transportation in Montgomery as a way to protest the racial segregation of people in public transportation in Alabama. When I was here as an undergraduate student at Barnard in the late 70s, we were boycotting grapes because the farm workers asked us to do so. We were boycotting oranges from Florida because you remember her, Anita Bryant, was the spokesperson for the Florida Orange Growers Association, and she was a horrible homophobe whose work in the 70s led to, in many respects, what we're dealing with now in the South around religious liberty as a way to formulate a backlash against marriage equality, but not only that. Jews have deployed boycotts at a number of points in history, not only boycotting Nazi goods or German goods around World War II, but here on the Lower East Side of New York, Jewish women boycotted Jewish butchers because their prices were too high for kosher meat. I can keep going, and some of you have heard me go on quite a bit about boycotts through history. It's hard to think of a social movement that hasn't at some point deployed economic boycotts as a way to mobilize people through solidarity with forms of injustice across the globe. Of course, the economic boycott of South Africa is the one we're in so many respects familiar with. But the boycott today of the State of Israel is the same kind of tactic to mobilize an international community to protest not Israeli individual citizens, not Jews generally, but laws and policies of the State of Israel that violate international humanitarian law, that violate the civil and human rights of Palestinian people living in the State of Israel, and certainly the rights of people in the occupied territories. So like other boycotts, the boycott of Israel and of Israeli laws is designed to protest state policy and state laws that we feel are unjust and that we feel violate the civil and human rights of a range of people living in Israel and in areas controlled by Israel. Never mind the people in the Palestinian diaspora who expect and demand a right of return to their homeland. What I find particularly interesting about the way that the boycott movement has moved in connection with solidarity with Palestinian people is that it's been so incredibly effective that domestically the opponents of boycott in this context have turned to law to essentially criminalize this particular political tactic. So we have a bill in the legislature in Albany pending right now that not many folks are talking about that would render you unable to bid on and receive contracts for projects funded by the state of New York if you have endorsed an economic boycott of an ally, an ally is defined to include Israel, but not only Israel. It could include Italy, where I have friends who are boycotting Italy because they won't let same-sex couples marry. It could include France, that has policies that many regard as discriminating against Muslim citizens of France. It could include a number of different boycotts that are being mobilized these days to protest the official state policies and laws of our allies. But of course, the motivation behind this bill in Albany is to target boycotts of Israel, economic boycotts of Israel. Not only would you be disqualified from bidding on public grants, the bill, if passed, would create and publish a state blacklist of people and institutions who have endorsed the economic boycott of an ally. Boycotts have a very bad odor to them, very bad odor historically in the United States, but generally worldwide. Blacklists remind us of the McCarthy era and the kind of lives, careers that were lost, that were stained permanently through a blacklist for those who were associated with the Communist Party. Blacklists were published in Ugandan newspapers, naming men who were suspected of being gay quite recently in an oddly named Rolling Stone magazine in Uganda. These kinds of blacklists are something, as politically active people, we should oppose. And it's certainly not an American value to have a state-sponsored blacklist of people who engage in constitutionally protected political activity, which is what boycotts are. And the Supreme Court has been very clear that economic boycotts amount to constitutionally protected economic or political activity. During the Montgomery bus boycott and other boycotts in the South, the businesses that were being boycotted brought a lawsuit against the NAACP, claiming that this was a form of basically unethical and illegal economic activity, coercive activity that the law should prohibit. Thankfully, the Supreme Court ruled against those businesses and said no, in the Claiborne Hardware case, said no, this is protected constitutional speech and political activity. But the American Jewish Congress submitted an amicus brief in this case, in the Claiborne Hardware case, saying that political boycotts had a long and important history among Jewish activists, consonant with Jewish values, and that the AJC supported the NAACP and other organizations that were using economic boycotts to advance their political goals as a tactic of their politics. Who wrote the AJC's amicus brief in the Claiborne Hardware case? Alan Dershowitz's brother. Not funny, really. I mean, yes, funny, but not funny. What we're seeing in the move now to render boycotts unacceptable form of political activity is the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment. Whatever one might think about the merits or demerits of certain Israeli state policies and practices, surely we would defend the use of boycotts as a way to express our political values in this case, because if we don't in this case, we jeopardize the next case that you might agree with. So as a matter of principle, the kinds of laws that are pending in Albany and were passed in the state of Illinois and are pending in other state legislatures are problematic from a whole range of perspectives having to do with First Amendment rights to speech and to political action, where we're trying to express solidarity with people who are making human rights claims across the globe. So take a moment, check out what this bill is that's pending in Albany. I know many of you have been active in opposing the bill. It may just sneak through like things do in Albany with no hearing and no transparent vote. So if you have a problem with the bill, and I hope you do, regardless of your position on the boycott of Israel, you should care about this bill because of the things you do care about in your own political work. What I'm going to do is pass the stage off to Rebecca Vilcomerson from Jewish Voice for Peace, who Lizzie is about to introduce more thoroughly, who will talk a little bit about the ways in which the boycott of Israel has been misunderstood as anti-Semitic in nature. If there's anything you can draw from my remarks, it's that boycotts are a tactic of politics more generally. There's nothing inherently anti-Semitic about them. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Franke. Our next speaker is Rebecca Vilcomerson. She's the Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace and has been a member of that organisation since 2001. JVP opposes anti-Jewish, anti-Muslim and anti-Arab bigotry and oppression, and I thought it was worth reading out to you their mission statement to give you an idea of what the work that they do if you're unfamiliar with the organisation. JVP's mission is to seek an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, security and self-determination for Israelis and Palestinians, a just solution for Palestinian refugees based on principles established in international law, and an end to violence against civilians and peace and justice for all peoples of the Middle East. Please welcome Rebecca.
I'm not going to say much more about Jewish Voice for Peace, given there's so much limited time and so much to say. But I did want to say, in terms of why I'm here, we do have a presence on the Barnard and Columbia campus. We have a very fierce and wonderful JVP chapter. Lots of snaps. Which works very closely, really in a beautiful partnership with SJP. So that's been really wonderful to see that evolving in the last couple of years. And then also we have an academic advisory council. So we have about 700 faculty who are members of our council. We're very honored and proud that Catherine is on the steering committee of that body. And I'm also very grateful to Catherine for giving the overview of boycott, because I really am going to jump into a sort of, not a 101 conversation about BDS, but a 201 conversation. And part of that is because I just feel like it's the one of the things that we're seeing right now are almost every day on campuses, new cases around the country of accusations of anti-Semitism being used to suppress conversation about boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS, and I wanted to sort of lay out some of the observations that I've made in seeing a number of these across campus, but really setting out some questions and challenges. I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of a comprehensive answer to how we deal with these questions, but I wanted to sort of talk about what seems to be emerging in terms of not just one campus, another campus, but across the country. So it's important to note from the outset, and I think this is really important, is that the BDS movement is really gaining steam in the U.S. So we've just had recent wins, G4S, Ahava, church divestment, campus divestment, even the anti-BDS legislation that Catherine talked about, I see in some ways as an indicator of how strong the BDS movement has grown and how much there's a backlash against it. So the increased reliance is on accusations of anti-Semitism when talking about BDS, I think, need to be very much understood in that context. And then I also want to make sure that everyone's aware of the fact that there's very little honest grappling from BDS opponents, of course, not just with BDS as a set of tactics, but also with the conditions in Palestine that led to the call for BDS. So we're seeing more and more really gratuitous attacks and attempts to literally legislate against BDS. There's actually 22 states where there's legislation similar to what Catherine described in New York, and these attacks happening all over campuses. So this is clearly being used as a specific strategy. And I also want to point out that these attacks are not emerging spontaneously. They're really orchestrated by an array of very well-funded organizations that are specifically dedicated to fighting BDS on campus. So Sheldon Adelson, tens of millions of dollars, Campus Maccabees, the Israeli government, tens of millions of dollars, all kinds of organizations that are very specifically trying to stop the BDS movement and are using this particular argument to do so. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with what happened at the UC Regents a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to speak about it in like three sentences, although we could talk for hours about it. But basically, after a long battle, the UC Regents just passed some principles of tolerance that originally had language that said that basically equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and called it a form of discrimination. After a lot of pressure from students, a lot of fight back, that language was watered down to say anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism, which I don't know how that's different from anti-Semitism per se, but so there was, to some ways, the damage was mitigated. But there is a lot of concern about chilling effect. Who will decide what are anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism? So I think that's one thing, that battle that's happening on campus. It's also, we've seen on CUNY in the last few weeks. I'm sure a lot of you are aware of what's happening there. I'm going to go back to that in a minute. But one thing I wanted to point out is that right after this UC Regents principles passed at Stanford just last week, there was immediately a pro-Israel group introduced a resolution using a quote from the UC principles saying that trying to attack BDS is anti-Semitic. And so it's literally trying to move this as a strategy from campus to campus, creating facts on the ground, if you'll excuse the phrase, to try to redefine what anti-Semitism is and redefine BDS as anti-Semitic. What happened with that resolution is that it was introduced, it was ultimately tabled, but also part of that story is that one of the students in the Senate that was considering this resolution, who was not affiliated with the SJP, who was not affiliated with any of the student activist groups, what I would consider to be anti-Semitic remarks in the course of that. He talked about Jews controlling the media, controlling the government, controlling institutions of power. So what do we do when we have this conflation of both attempts to call BDS anti-Semitic, to call anti-Zionism anti-Semitic, but also occasionally actual anti-Semitic speech that comes out? How do we disentangle that, and how do we address that in a way that's ethical, in a way that's moral, in a way that's strategic, and still continue to move the BDS movement forward? I think that's what we actually really need to do. So of course, I think and hope we all agree that we all must speak out against anti-Semitism when it actually occurs, but that we also, of course, need to talk about and reinforce the fact that the leadership of the BDS movement and all the SJPs that I've worked with, at least in my experience, have been extremely clear about speaking out against anti-Semitism. This is not something that's coming from those parts of the movement, and any attempt to conflate them is really wrong. And I do want to try to articulate, even though I think it's a little bit messy still, how do we talk about anti-Semitism in today's political atmosphere? So we have to condemn it when it's really happening, but we also have to be clear about how structural anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-black sentiment, anti-immigrant oppression, all those are still structural problems in the United States, while anti-Semitism does not have structural support in society. The forms of anti-Semitism we face are generally interpersonal and without that kind of structural support and are immediately condemned. And yet there's an inverse in the amount of attention being paid to anti-Semitism, while there's this incredible amount of still racism, Islamophobia, and all these other kinds of oppressions that are happening. So how do we authentically condemn these kinds of anti-Semitic attacks while also putting them in balance with the reality of what students, faculty, and people in general in this country are facing? I think that is something that we all really need to be thinking about. And so, for example, the fact that the UC Regents was even doing a statement of principles that talked only about anti-Semitism and didn't mention any other forms of racism is an indicator of that. The fact that at CUNY, the Zionist Organization of America sent a letter saying that students were facing anti-Semitism on campus, and nobody even mentioned the fact that the NYPD had undercover policemen who were spying on Muslim students and reporting their activities, that is a structural problem. Anti-Semitic incidents are a problem, need to be condemned, but why aren't we talking about those structural issues and how are those structural issues being repressed? So we need to think about how to talk about that. The other thing is that I think it's very disturbing and we need to be talking more about the trend of actual anti-Semitic incidents being routinely blamed on Muslim and Arab students, or sometimes just on SJPs as a political body. And I think that is really giving actual anti-Semites, actual white supremacists, a total pass. So we see this, and I think Jewish institutions are extremely complicit in this. The moment there's an anti-Semitic incident that happens on any campus, you immediately see these attempts to connect it to BDS efforts on campus, to divestment efforts or whatever's happening on campus. And what does that say about how we're not addressing actual white supremacy, actual anti-Semitism that still exists? And it's really placing the blame on folks who are most vulnerable. So we need to figure out how to talk better about that. I do think that the conversation at the UC Regents was actually a step forward. I think it made discussion about anti-Zionism a legitimate political conversation in a way it hasn't been recently. There was a conversation in the New York Times about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism that I don't remember happening before. Peter Beinart's writing about it. All kinds of people about are writing now about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism and how they're different. And I think it opens a space to point out that there's actually a long history of Jewish anti-Zionism that's actually been flattened out in the past few decades. In fact, Zionism was always opposed by Bundists, by communists, by Orthodox Jews, just to give a few examples, the parts of the Jewish community that have opposed Zionism. And so I think we need to continue to bring back those pieces of our history and make it clear that Zionism is not synonymous with Judaism, and that to criticize the actions of a state is not to criticize the Jewish people. To me, that seems like the clearest and cleanest distinction in how to distinguish between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. At the same time, we need to be on the alert to call out white supremacist anti-Zionism. So you have people like David Duke who call themselves pro-Palestinian, but that doesn't necessarily make you part of our movement, right? Our movement is about being committed to principles of freedom and equality and justice for all people. And so we do have these elements that are out there, and it's about defining who is part of our movement. And I also think, just a couple of final thoughts, I do think this conversation is an opportunity to recenter the experiences of Palestinians under Zionism in public discourse. And I think maybe I'll leave it there, because I do see this moment as a real opportunity. There's some danger in it, but there's an opportunity to really refine and articulate a vision of justice that applies to all people, to speak out clearly and ethically against all forms of racism and oppression, and also to really challenge the centering of Jewish experience when talking about Palestine. And I think there's a beautiful article that came out recently from Tufts, anonymous students at Tufts, who really challenged their fellow students to imagine what it felt like as a Palestinian to see their Jewish friends on campus getting free trips to Israel when they couldn't return to their homes even to visit. So how do we make sure that this conversation is really recentering those Palestinian voices? Thanks.
Thank you, Rebecca. Our final speaker before we have time for discussion is Sheza Abushi Dalal. Sheza is a Lebanese-Palestinian undergraduate at Barnard College, majoring in history. She's a long-term organizer with Students for Justice in Palestine and one of the founders of Columbia University Apartheid Divest. Please make her feel welcome.
Thank you, Lizzie, for putting this together. So as Lizzie said, I am a long-term member of Students for Justice in Palestine and the founder of a recent campaign, or one of the founders, one of the many founders of the recent campaign that we launched, Columbia University Apartheid Divest. And I'm really excited to be here today because we're always looking for opportunities to speak to larger crowds and people that we don't usually speak to, and the law school unfortunately belongs to one of the communities on this campus that we don't, as SJP, as Jewish Voice for Peace, as Apartheid Divest, usually get to interact with. So I think my general purpose, if Rebecca did a BDS 201, I'm going to backtrack and do a 101 for the room and really focus more on divestment, because that's what our recent campaign is. It's a divestment campaign. So, and also I would like to speak to you about kind of the historical trajectory of Palestine solidarity activism on campus, the type of backlash we face, the type of successes we have in general. So, Columbia University Apartheid Divest is a joint campaign launched by Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine and Columbia Barnard Jewish Voice for Peace. And we call upon the university to divest its stocks, funds, and endowment from companies that profit off of the State of Israel's apartheid system and military occupation of Palestinian territories. This campaign is embedded in the larger movement against boycott, that larger movement seeking boycott, divestment, and sanctions from the State of Israel, until it complies with international law by ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands occupied in June 1967 and dismantling the wall. 2, recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And 3, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194. So, for all the lawyers in the room, the law students, pretty basic compliance with international law, you know, appeals to kind of very, very basic, very non-radical principles of what we should be standing behind as institutions, as individuals. And I want to speak to you a bit about divestment as a tactic and the history of different divestment movements on campus, successful ones, not so successful ones. This specific divestment movement, we've made the focus of our divestment campaign nine specific corporations, because Columbia is a private institution and we don't have access to the full endowment, information about the full endowment and investments of Columbia. We have chosen nine corporations that we think give us an opportunity to illustrate the way in which a corporation can be
complicit
and can maintain a state of occupation and human rights violations in Palestine. And the idea is that by focusing on said corporations, we can demonstrate how a corporation can be directly involved in creating the technologies and the materials by which Israel maintains a state of policing, a state of continuous attacks upon a very vulnerable and constricted community, and an occupation. So the call for divestment comes most importantly from Palestine's civil society. Even if I, as an individual, am a Palestinian, or anyone else in SJP are Palestinians, we are, at the end of the day, a solidarity community. So we stand in solidarity with a call that is not our own. It is not the call of international communities abroad. It is the call of Palestine civil society. And it has proven in the past few years to be an incredibly powerful tool for exerting pressure, economic and political pressure, on a government that unfortunately continues to this day to get away with things that no other government does, with the very tangible financial and political support of this country. So we bring divestment to this campus, but this is actually not the first of very large influential divestment movements on this campus. On October 7th, 1985, the Board of Trustees voted to sell $41 million of its endowments and investments in American companies with South African connections, becoming the first Ivy League to join the movement to divest from South African apartheid. Then, too, our administration prioritized investment in profit-generating corporations over that which is morally sound. Then, too, it was argued that irrespective of the injustices committed under South African apartheid, total divestment would hinder economic prosperity for this institution. And then, too, it was the unity of activists across the spectrum of socially and politically minded organizers on this campus that courageously spoke truth to power and slowly but surely disrupted the mainstream hegemonic narrative on this campus. Most recently, on June 22, 2015, Columbia University Board of Trustees voted to sell its stocks in Corrective Corporation of America and G4S, making Columbia the first academic institution in the United States of America to divest from the private prison industry. This was not the brainchild of a President Bollinger who woke up one day and decided that he was no longer okay with having the university invest in a private prison industry. It was not. It was the fruit of labor of CU Prison Divest's victory, and it inspired a sense of purpose in the persistence of activists on campus who believe in divestment as a tactic and who believe that solidarity networks, persistent pressure placed on an institution's administration, can actually result in this type of tangible political and economic pressure. And this is actually not even the first attempt on our campus to hold the administration accountable to its involvement in bolstering Israel's administration of military occupation. In 2002, faculty members across various departments called for an end to our investment in all firms that supplied Israel's military with arms and military hardware. This was a precursor of sorts to the type of divestment that BDS demands, but it was a very powerful one, and it was met with very strong statements from the administration and from the rest of campus, and unfortunately it failed. But I mention it because it's important to place this specific divestment campaign in a longer history of holding our government and our academic institutions accountable to the type of implicity. So unfortunately, it's, as I was stating, not our administration's natural instinct to stand on the right side of history. It's a lot of work. We don't have to go that far back to notice trends in campus populist unaccountability. We can consider our administration's systematic oppression of its workers today. We can consider our campus's expansive exploits into West Harlem, making our administration directly implicated in socioeconomically harmful trend that is gentrification. And we can consider our administration's very recent $10 million investment in the private prison industry. So when I was preparing some of these notes for you all today, I was thinking I'm going to speak at the law school. I have to appeal to law students. And really, the point that I want to drive home is that this movement is one that demands political accountability to international law violations that directly impacts the subject of your academic study and your professional careers to come. And the type of backlash we face is also a massive violation of First Amendment rights, in free speech in this country. So a Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal joint report titled The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, from which we get the name of this event, came out this fall documenting over 300 incidents of repression. Columbia University has the highest count of those incidents, the highest counts documented. If I may, would like to give a few examples. Do I have time?
Sure.
Okay. So in March 2014, we experienced the removal of a banner. And it's a very famous incident that we speak about at almost every single event, but I think it's very important because it embodies so many of the types of struggles that we face as Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, and generally Palestine Solidarity activists. We hung an administration-approved banner on the building at the entrance of Barnard College. And overnight, due to the influx of complaints that, as Rebecca noted, are never spontaneous, it was removed. This is not an isolated incident. We are always pushed out of spaces in which our voice is a powerful one. And it is not spontaneous. We have, since the launch of our divestment campaign, I'm going to cut the examples because I want to have time for a conversation, but since the launch of our divestment campaign, we have had two petitions released. One has 200 plus signatures of faculty members opposing BDS, and that type of mobilization is very serious. The second is in response to a statement made by our allies, the International Socialist Organization, that included the word intifada. 600 plus signatures were collected, demanding that SJP, that made no such statements about the intifada, condemn the use of the word intifada, which refers to 600 plus made up of community members, which refers to a Palestinian resistance movements, the first and the second intifada. And we're asked to condemn this because it is terrorism. And this is a type of policing of vocabulary and of actions and involvement that is far too frequent. We also had this new McCarthyite website called Canary Mission. It's not very new, actually. It's 2 years old. But the week after we released our divestment campaign, this website, and their motto is ensuring that today's radicals are not tomorrow's employees or something like that. We had 40 profiles from Columbia published within a week. My personal profile is something like 9 pages long. I have an infamous quote section, 8 videos, and something like 45 photos of myself posted. And, you know, even my parents are mentioned in the thing. And this is, you know, if you Google my first name, this comes up on the first page. So this is not just an effort to delegitimize a movement, it's also to delegitimize the individuals so that before the administration comes and shuts down whatever actions, whatever banner you've put up, you self-censor yourself. And we don't have a large community of people standing with us, people standing in solidarity, people organizing directly with us. So where do you move forward from here? How do you grow? You grow. We need to embrace the principles of intersectionality that so many different social justice movements have at their core in today's organizing. It is very difficult for student groups to stand with us because they end up being faced with the same type of repression that we do. When different student clubs were issuing statements of support with us, they all came to us saying, we have never in our experience of organizing received this many complaints, this many death threats, emails threatening our physical safety on this campus, and that really is indicative of something, but it's important. And now for the first time on our campus, we have something called the Barnard Columbia Solidarity Network that really taps into those types of intersectional social justice organizing. It's made up of No Red Tape, the Anti-Sexual Assault Organization, the International Socialist Organization, Columbia Divest for Climate Justice, Barnard Divest, also for Climate Justice, Mobilize African Diaspora, Student Worker Solidarity, Jewish Voice for Peace, and JVP. We organize together, and that type of network is really invaluable because our movement needs to be a diverse one. And to the law students in this room and the graduate students in this room, I say that the higher up in academic ranks that you get, the more it is not just a cause worthy of your attention, but a cause that you are responsible for. Because you are more likely to not only be a student, but an employee of the university. You are more likely to be paying rent. You are more likely to be directly contributing to the scholarship and publications of this university. And that means that what we are invested in is your responsibility. So I urge you to organize with us, join us.
You have been listening to a Columbia University Law School forum on the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Or if you wish to hear the program later in the day or within a 2-week period via the WZBC archive, simply access the WZBC homepage and click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. If you miss a program on the WZBC archive, remember it is only on this archive for 2 weeks. You can find any of our past broadcasts on our permanent archive, meticulously maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. To reach our permanent archive to hear any past broadcast, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. And click on This Week in Palestine Archives. All of our past broadcasts are on truthandjusticeradio.org archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be a conversation with anthropologist, professor, and Israeli activist Jeff Halper. We will discuss Jeff's new book, which explores Israel's burgeoning weapons development and security technology industry that has become the center of the Israeli economy. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.